You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the combined July-August 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Grand Tour, L'Avion Rose, by Keziah Weir. Huge character and tiny dogs populate Danielle Steele's Paris apartment, with illustrations by Alexandra Compantissier. I don't like depressing stories. I don't like depressing art, says Danielle Steele, the gallerist and ultra-prolific author of two new summer books, Daddy's Girls and Royal, both out from Delacorte Press. I like art that you look at and you feel good. She splits her time between her San Francisco home and her Paris apartment. In Paris, where she spent months in pandemic-induced isolation, her penchant for mood-lifting environs has created an eclectic mix. A formal sitting room in which Japanese and Chinese antiques abut zebra-printed furniture picked out by an ex-husband. A bedroom brimming with small items that remind her of her children, and a desk dotted with hartbibelots where she spends much of her days writing on an Olympia typewriter. The underlying theme in a lot of my books is hope, she says. Hard things happen to the people, but they've survived them. That's really the message that we need right now, that this is really hard, but we will survive it. In the photos, some of my kids like this room better than their own apartments. My girls particularly think it's much chicer. I'm a lousy cook. I always have been, but I make a fabulous peanut butter sandwich. Steele's Chihuahuas, Lily, Blue, and Minnie. I travel everywhere with them. I've always loved canopy beds. They're like a nest. There's so much here that gives me pleasure, things that have no value, things that have great value. I do the outline by hand, and then I type it twice to refine it down. Then the whole book. I do 5 drafts in all. on to books. Jam Session, a new cookbook from Squirrel, the cult favorite Los Angeles cafe, revisits its origin story at a moment when the pantry is a pleasure center, by Laura Regensdorf. In the photos, a raspberry rhubarb blend, a look inside the Squirrel Jam Book, California peaches, preserves on ricotta toast. When I say picky, I did not eat fruit, Jessica Coslow says of her childhood palate, the sole exception being raspberries. In a twist, the chef grew up to be a produce whisperer, creating a line of jams in 2011 called Squirrel. When her cafe opened a year later, ricotta toast, slicked with preserves, drew devotees. Now, amid a bread-making boom, the Squirrel Jam Book proposes an apt hobby. Photographed by creative director Scott Barry, the book is full of unexpected whimsy, from impromptu sculptures to recipes that bubble like the La Brea tar pits. Seek out local fruit or order a jar of Coslow's Persian mulberry. Jam sales have helped keep Squirrel aloft in this challenging time. Preserves, indeed. It's the heart and soul of everything that we do, she says. The Politics of Politesse, by Keziah Weir. There are two overarching goals of diplomatic protocol, to bridge and to persuade. Capricia Pinovich Marshall writes in Protocol, The Power of Diplomacy and How to Make It Work for You. The new book from the former chief of protocol to President Obama and social secretary to the Clintons serves as a how-to guide on ironclad etiquette. Marshall once had a table of high-powered dinner partiers making okay signs to learn that B for bread is on the left, D for drink is on the right. It is also a memoir of the perks and perils of the job, respectively, watching Britain's David Cameron and Obama bond over basketball, accidentally adopting the accent of Her Majesty the Queen. Admiration Society. Authors of Vanity Fair beloved novels out this summer share their own must-reads, old and new. David Mitchell, author of the frolicsome psychedelic rock drama Utopia Avenue, recommends Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, a jaw-droppingly accomplished novel about Shakespeare's family and ethos, the intertwining of art and life, and the dusk between life and death. Heartbreaking and yet heart-mending, too. Raven Leilani, author of the sharp Mores Plumbing Luster, recommends Heads of the Colored People by Nafisa Thompson Spires. Heads of the Colored People resist easy categorization, rendering both the joys and absurdities of black life with great care. Lee Connell, author of The Manhattan Superintendent-Centric, The Party Upstairs, recommends Penin by Vladimir Nabokov. Nabokov called the lovable émigré Penin his sunny escape from Lolita. The professor's sense of discombobulation and loss is portrayed with meticulous sweetness, just what I need this summer. Leslie Tenorio, author of the trenchant family comedy The Son of Good Fortune, recommends The Likely World by Melanie Conroy Goldman. A woman's addiction to a short-term memory-erasing drug is at the center of Conroy Goldman's debut. Present and past collide. Themes of motherhood and sex clash. A mesmerizing novel, unlike anything I've read. on to music, the spirit moves. The Portland Trail Blazers all-star point guard and rapper Damian Lillard brings his game on the court and on the mic by Lisa Robinson. In the photos, NBA point guard Damian Lillard, also known as musician Dame Dalla. How did you get the nickname Dame Dalla? My college roommates called me Dame Dalla, and then I decided to use it as my rap name. But I turned Dalla into an acronym. It stands for Different on Levels the Lord Allows. You can really rhyme, but many basketball stars who rap aren't taken seriously. I think people just respect my rap because I didn't skip steps. It's a passion I picked up before my status as NBA player. I took the route of any other aspiring artist. I started a platform on Instagram called #4BarFriday, where you rapped 4 bars. I got some big basketball names to do it, LeBron James, Paul George, CJ McCollum, and basically created a whole community. I started dropping freestyles every Monday, performing little shows in Portland and Washington, then started getting tweets from people who actually wanted to hear me make more music. What was that battle about that you and Shaquille O'Neal engaged in last year? The battle with Shaq was not personal. He took offense to something I said and decided to diss me. So we settled it in a lyrical spar, but since then we've done a song together and communicate often through text. Who were your musical influences growing up, and who do you still listen to? I love Tupac, Nas, Andre 3000, Common, Lil Wayne. Lil Wayne is on all three of my albums. When I started putting out my rap music, he heard my stuff. We connected and started talking and became really good friends. How has your music evolved from your last album to what you're working on now? In this era, they want the bounce or the mumble rap, but I love Nas and J. Cole. That's more of my style. With this new one, I'm giving 100% authenticity of how I think and feel, being more vulnerable. Much of rap music is about struggle. Did you have a rough childhood? I did have a rough childhood. I come from a real strong family, a lot of aunts, uncles, cousins, and grandparents. We had dinner, we had school clothes, we didn't have everything, but our life was fine. But the environment where we grew up in Oakland was rough. Do you feel the current protests in response to George Floyd's murder have exposed systemic racism in a new way? Do you think there will be real change? I don't think systemic racism was exposed more this time than in recent years. I just think we as black people have had enough of the bullshit. We've reached that breaking point. Our ancestors dealt with inequality, slavery, segregation, lynching, etc. Now we have so many instances where what we knew existed is in our faces on camera, and there are never any repercussions or remorse shown. It's always justified somehow. As far as real change, I think the unity being shown across the nation and in other countries is delivering a strong message and applying true pressure. There are also more people in search of ways to take true action toward change and not just be part of the outcry. So I think now, more than any other time, we are moving in the direction of change. Watch List, Court Order, Richard Lawson reviews the newest iteration of a classic legal drama. This ain't your granddaddy's Perry Mason, though he might also enjoy HBO's new take on author Earl Stanley Gardner's iconic character. Beloved for decades on television in the form of Raymond Burr, the defense lawyer gets new life from the Americans veteran Matthew Rhys. A hard-boiled noir full of blood, sex, and profanity, this Perry Mason is both daring and artful in the manner of today's glossiest prestige television. Joining Rhys is a rogues gallery of talent, including Tatiana Maslany, Orphan Black, Juliet Rylance, The Nick, and Gail Rankin, Glow. The show is rich with period detail and a grim pathos that adds resonance to the courtroom intrigue. An engrossing 8-episode origin story that sets the table for future legal adventures. In the photos, Monty Markham in the 1973 single-season revival The New Perry Mason. Matthew Rhys stars in the HBO adaptation. A radio serial adaptation ran on CBS from 1943 to 1955. Earl Stanley Gardner wrote 82 books in the series beginning in 1933. Raymond Burr. Debbie Reynolds in the 1989 TV movie The Case of the Musical Murder. A Ghost from Our Past by Sonia Soraya. In the photo, Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze throwing more than clay. The clay transforms beneath Demi Moore's hands as Patrick Swayze slide over them. The Righteous Brothers croon Unchained Melody mournfully from the jukebox. Ghost won Whoopi Goldberg an Oscar and cemented Swayze's heartthrob status, but the 1990 film is best known for its unbridled eroticism behind the pottery wheel, a thirst that even death can't quench. Now, at its 30th anniversary, the film is hallucinatory. New York's streets are crowded. Swayze and Tony Goldwyn joke about contagion in a packed elevator, and the cozy lover's nest in Soho is the size of a goddamn Madewell. But it's still more relevant than ever. Ghost is a paean to grief, a blueprint for sobbing your heart out. At its center is Goldberg's Oda Mae Brown, an irrepressible, opinionated medium who adds unadulterated attitude to the sweeping emotions of a young widow. She walks the characters through the struggle of saying goodbye, seasoning bitter truths with salty humor. I defy you not to laugh at her droll delivery of Molly, you in danger, girl. As cities remain shuttered, we need Oda Mae and Ghost dedication to its timeless love more than ever. We wait, we mourn, we cry, we heal. Time goes by so slowly, go those lyrics, and time can do so much. about-face. When our bodies fall out of view, what remains on screen has our undivided attention. Marissa Meltzer considers the new primacy of the face. Opening photo, working with the only models available, many makeup artists in quarantine created experimental looks on themselves. It's early on a Sunday evening, and I'm watching as Julianne Moore's face fills the frame in Tom Ford's 2009 film A Single Man, her eyes generously lined and false eyelashes applied just so. My phone pings with an alarm for a video call. By now, we have heard what Ford, a designer whose clothes telegraph sex appeal, has to say about looking good on camera, and I allow him to direct my close-up. I stack a few books under my laptop and angle a lamp in an approximation of flattering light. It's just a check-in with friends, but if this is the only way I am seeing them, I might as well put my best face forward. It has come to this. After years spent agonizing over the shape of our bodies above all else, this panoply of screens has narrowed our worldview, concentrating our focus and our concerns above the neck. Whether we're FaceTiming with family, tuning in to see Florence Pugh make marmalade on Instagram Live, or joining a 20-person Zoom meeting for work, we are all disembodied faces now. No wonder we don't feel wholly ourselves. I thought I would feel a rush of relief that no one could see my lower half, a freedom that I could participate in all those video chats in sweatpants or no pants. Instead, I feel exposed in this all-face, all-the-time moment. It's not easy to see a thumbnail of my face talking back at me. What a triggering word, Zoom, for all those who avoid looking too closely in the mirror. Each perceived imperfection is amplified. Close-ups betray our every emotion, our exhaustion, our inescapable aging. It's as if this glut of screen time has turned the usual voyeurism of modern culture inward, so that by constantly seeing ourselves, we've become our own reality TV stars. I didn't sign up to be the face of anything, says Brooklyn-based facialist Lara Kaiser. Like many whose hands-on work evaporated with the stay-at-home orders, she felt the pressure to stay relevant by assuming a place in front of a camera, posting tutorials on social media. I did buy a ring light and have done two videos that were well received, but it doesn't come naturally to me, Kaiser says. She is not about to join TikTok to post Get Ready With Me videos along with Gen Z. Mostly, she has been sending her clients private videos of Gua Sha tutorials or helping them do basic brow maintenance over FaceTime. I like to make other people pretty. The desire for improvement doesn't end during a shutdown. Wrinkles, under-eye circles, and maskne, the portmanteau for irritated skin and clogged pores exacerbated by face coverings, might send us seeking the quick-fix technological aid offered by filters. I am a loyal convert to the touch-up-my-appearance option on Zoom, which, according to the platform, can help smooth out the skin tone on your face to present a more polished-looking appearance when you display your video to others. But a filter only takes you so far. Months into quarantine, my not-even-vain friends have asked me about maintenance, the blanket term for the toolkit of non-invasive procedures that can be subtly deployed to forestall the inevitable. Next photo, endless self-reflection has prompted a surge of interest in wrinkle-minimizing procedures. Squinting into the screen at the ever-deepening web of crow's feet, intensified further by said squinting, has a way of steering people toward injectables. I've never heard of people wanting Botox so bad, says Lisa Goodman, the owner of Good Skin, a med spa with locations in Los Angeles and New York City. A lot of people have never gone this long without it. We got offered money to make house calls and said no, although I know people who did them. Ahead of the LA clinic's reopening back in May, devotees claimed a spot on the wait list for the first appointments. After sheltering in place to flatten a rising curve, people clamored for treatments intended to flatten another one, the nosedive into old. Were it not for the temporary stop, since lifted, on elective surgery, this would have been a perfect time to get a facelift or a new nose. Lie low for a few months, letting things comfortably heal behind a mask, and voila, you emerge from your quarantine chrysalis with a whole new identity. Still, makeup remains the original and arguably more recession-friendly means of transformation. In late April, an unrecognizable Kylie Jenner stunned the paparazzi and fans when she emerged without the usual spackling of contour and highlight. It was an extreme make-under, a dismantling of illusion. The photos circling the internet recalled an Oscar Wilde line, "A man's face is his autobiography, a woman's face is her work of fiction." Much as we like to think that the pandemic is an equalizing force, the gender divide in beauty, as in parenting, proves to be largely intact. One master of makeup transformation was the 90s icon Kevin O'Quan, who had a talent for giving one celebrity another's likeness. During the downtime in recent months, makeup artists have been using their own faces as canvases. I was craving playing with makeup and touch-up makeup, says Grace Ahn, the New York-based makeup artist who has refashioned herself into an ashes-to-ashes era David Bowie, Andy Warhol's Mick Jagger painting, and longtime Vogue editor Diana Vreeland, who went heavy on the blush. Fellow makeup artists often joined in via the group video app House Party to show off their wild solo experiments. At first, Ahn found it strange to navigate around her own asymmetries and idiosyncratic features, more comfortable playing artist than model, but she settled into the idea. "When it comes to makeup, it's never perfect, because faces are not perfect," she says. "I transferred that philosophy to myself." The project has changed her notion of perfection, and by extension, marveling at a face usually behind the scenes might succeed in changing our perspectives too. Laura Regensdorf writes on beauty, undercover operations. In your eagerness to get out the door, trying to remember wallets and keys, along with new precautionary essentials, don't forget about the golden oldie, sunscreen. Immediate threats are always going to be more front of mind than things that are long-term, says Sherry Pagotto, Ph.D., a professor in the Department of Allied Health Sciences at the University of Connecticut. She keeps SPF by the door to put on before her daily run, everything in its place, from the glow-inducing product for Zoom calls to the hands-free mist for the tote bag. And some products pictured here, sensitive subject, the Milky Mineral Sunscreen glides on invisibly, 11 by Venus Williams, Unrivaled Sun Serum, SPF 35. Outside interest, this spritz is an easy way to reapply, even over makeup, Neutrogena Ultra Sheer Face Mist Sunscreen, SPF 55. Sports Arena, this surfer-approved formula holds up by land or by sea. Shiseido Ultimate Sun Protector Cream, SPF 50+. Meeting hour, with a dewy finish, this so-called primer is a complexion boost in itself. Supergoop Glow Screen Sunscreen, SPF 40. The eyes have it. If the lipstick effect is economics speak for the beauty industry's perpetual buoyancy, the eyes now provide the lift. If you've got to wear a mask, what a great opportunity to work this shit, you know, says Marc Jacobs, who has been posting dramatic eye looks on Instagram. His new mascara, Jazz Hands of the Eye, and Gold Shimmers spell a disco summer. Pictured here, Victoria Beckham Beauty Eye Palette in Silk, Tom Ford Beauty Cream and Powder Eye Duo in Golden Peach, Marc Jacobs at Lashed Mascara.
Thank you.
Vanity Fair agenda, promotions, events. Watch the Old Guard, led by Andy, Charlize Theron, a group of mercenaries with a mysterious inability to die, has fought to protect the world for centuries. When their abilities are exposed, it's up to Andy and Niall, Kiki Lane, to help eliminate the threat. Directed by Gina Prince Bythewood, The Old Guard is a gritty, grounded, action-packed story that shows living forever is harder than it looks. Now on Netflix. Inside the Hive, with Emily Jane Fox and Joe Hagan, a Vanity Fair podcast. How long will the coronavirus crush the economy? Is Donald Trump toast in November? What will change look like after the protest? Emily Jane Fox and Joe Hagan bring you inside the rooms where decisions are made through in-depth, revealing conversations with the biggest newsmakers in Silicon Valley, on Wall Street, and in Washington. Event. Ladies, start your engines. From sponsorship of Formula One race teams to working with professional drivers, Swiss watchmaker Richard Mille has integrated himself with the world of motorsports from its inception. Richard Mille Racing Team, helmed exclusively by three female drivers, represents the first all-female team competing in the ELMS Endurance Racing Championship in the LMP2 category. The season highlight is nothing less than September's 24 Hours of Le Mans, the world's oldest active sports car endurance race. right-wing conspiracy, traitors among us. Pop culture goes soft on some of the more controversial women in American history by Sonia Soraya. Opening photo, Kate Blanchett, playing Phyllis Schlafly in the miniseries Mrs. America. The people who drive pop culture seem mystified by Republican women. Perhaps it's simply that by design, they seem to recede in plain sight. The Barbara Bushes and Nancy Reagans of the world, with their out-of-date hairstyles, monochromatic twin sets, and strings of demure pearls. Our biopics and investigative reports rarely delve into their psyche. So thoroughly do these women fulfill our ideas of a type that the mind glosses over them and moves on to the man they are invariably standing next to. For all that Hollywood and the mainstream media are supposed to be a hotbed of liberal propaganda, we pull our punches when it comes to the tales of handmaidens of conservative politics. If women's suffrage anticipated a voting bloc comprised of women voting for women's issues, the 2016 election shredded that notion. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.